This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is pianist Jeremy Dank. If you've ever taken music lessons, or if you appreciate the insights musicians share about the music they play, I think you'll enjoy what he has to say. He's an acclaimed classical pianist who's also a fine writer, with a gift for explaining the structure of the pieces he performs and what makes them technically and emotionally exciting. He's written a new memoir called Every Good Boy Does Fine, A Love Story in Music Lessons. The title refers to a phrase children learn when they first start to read music to help them memorize the notes on the five lines of the treble clef. Those notes, E, G, B, D, F, correspond to the first letter of each word in Every Good Boy Does Fine. The book is about how he learned to play, the teachers who shaped him, and what it was like to be a classical prodigy in a world where few kids cared about classical music and some truly hated it. Dank received a MacArthur Fellowship, a.k.a. the Genius Award, and the Avery Fisher Prize. His recording of the Goldberg Variations reached number one on the Billboard Classical Chart. His album of compositions by Beethoven and Ligeti was named one of the best discs of the year by The New Yorker, NPR, and The Washington Post. In The New York Times, music critic Steve Smith wrote that Dank is a pianist you want to hear no matter what he performs, and that his interpretations conveyed the sense of composers grappling with the ineffable, inventing new vocabulary to express the inexpressible. Jeremy Dank, welcome back to Fresh Air. It's such a pleasure to have you back on our show. You have a really interesting album from a couple of years ago in which you play piano music from 1300 to 2000. So the album is aptly called Circa 1300 to Circa 2000. So I want to start with a Bach piece from that album. This is Bach's Chromatic Fantasy and Fugue in D minor. Can you just say a little bit about why you love this piece and why you chose it for this album?
You know, I love all the pieces of Bach where you get a taste of him maybe improvising and his virtuosity, both as a composer, of course, you know, but as a performer, this sense of touching the keyboard at the beginning, playing some scales to sort of hear how it sounds, you know, hearing how the harmonies play against each other, and then beginning to explore the world of harmony bit by bit, you know. And it's called Chromatic Fantasy because it explores not just the notes of the normal D minor scale, but all the naughty notes in between, you know. And he really makes a point of visiting the weirdest chords that he can and trying to make harmonic sense of them, something he loved doing. So, yeah, I guess I feel like I'm slightly channeling Bach a little bit when you play this piece. The demonic elements of Bach and then the really sublime parts of him too.
Well, let's hear it. This is Jeremy Dank at the piano. That was Jeremy Dank playing the Bach Chromatic Fantasia and Fugue in D minor. So, Jeremy, that's why you have to learn to play scales, right? That's where all of your work, like learning scales, playing them over and over again, really pays off because you can just, that is such a complicated piece, but it's built on scales.
It's built on scales, and then there's all these kind of whirls and curls and curly cues and kind of devilish turns within the scales. But yes, there was a reason why you had to suffer all those years of piano lessons.
Your book is so much about piano lessons. Did you hate it when you had to spend hours and hours earlier in your life playing scales, and when like some of your teachers didn't even want to play music with you, you know, have you play music for them until you mastered like the basics, the scales?
Yeah, my teacher when I was in my, you know, early teens, we spent summers basically only on technique with very little music, right? And those were his moments to sort of have me under his control and build a foundation. And I admit, I didn't love those summers, though I would probably not be a pianist without them. I think one of the real problems when you're practicing, at least for me when I was a kid, is you just don't know what the point of all that time is. You repeat something over and over, you know, hundreds of times. And at a certain point, there's a futility and you're not sure what you're doing, what you're changing, what the job is you're really engaged in. And that's one of the hardest tasks for a teacher, I think, is to make it clear to the student what practicing is about.
Well, how did they make it clear to you in a meaningful way?
Well, a lot of it, of course, is like you would do with a tennis coach, right? Or whatever. You have to pay attention to physical changes that you have to make, and you have to kind of try to build certain physical habits and get rid of others, you know, and we all have bad habits in one way or another. And then you know, what to pay attention to for a while, and then when to let go of it, when to feel you've mastered it and you can go on to the next thing. You know, I wish that my teachers when I was a kid had been able to codify a little bit more what it is. And lately I've come up with a little bit of a formula that I use, which is every time you try to play something again, you explain to yourself what the physical changes you're going to make it better the next time. And that slows you down.
Physical, like in your hands?
Yeah. Are you going to raise your thumb more? Are you going to bring your second finger down more slowly? Are you going to use your wrist more? Are you going to engage the arm? You know, it could be a lot of different things. But for me anyway, you really have to remember the role of the body in making the music sing.
In the piece that we heard, the Bach piece, it's a very complicated piece. You're playing lots of notes in each hand at a rapid speed, and you also have to breathe. And I, you know, speaking for myself, when I'm doing something really complicated, I don't think I actually breathe. Or if I do breathe, it's really shallow breathing. Did you have to learn how to breathe while playing?
Yeah, most definitely I did. And I still do. And one of the beautiful things that Shebeck explained that I maybe didn't put in the book, my teacher, George Shebeck in Bloomington, was that there is a beautiful parallel between, you know, breathing with your lungs, as we all do and must do, and the kind of breathing of the muscles in the act of piano playing, you know, releasing your wrist or elbow or whatever it is. And he would often show, you know, his arms like a bellows, kind of, allowing the sound to blossom because you let the muscles release the energy that you put into the piano. And that is a lesson that I keep having to teach myself, especially, you know, in nervous situations, because your body begins to breathe less, right, by the nature of adrenaline, or breathe differently. And that's a whole other study to figure out how to cope with that in front of a public.
So you mentioned your teacher, Georges Shebeck, who was your teacher when you were at Oberlin in your final year there. And he was a pianist from Hungary who'd performed with the top musicians and conductors and would tell you stories about them. What did he teach you about breathing? Because he talked to you about different composers' breaths. I'm not really sure what that means. What did that mean to you?
Well, for him, it was very important that each composer kind of spoke his or her own language. And those languages relied on different kinds of breaths. For example, Bach, you know, loves to elide. He loves to create these kind of endless rivers of notes, you know. And there are very few rests in Bach. But by the time you get to Mozart, you know, 70 years later or whatever, almost everything is about little clipped phrases with tiny commas and punctuation between them, right? And the way that you hear those little silences and the way that you think about them, often changing character from one thing to another, you know, from the imperious count or whatever to the, you know, pleading Susanna or whatever, The way that you thought about the punctuation changed everything, yeah? And so you had to think about the breaths between the phrases as much as anything else, because they indicated when you changed from one person to another, in a way. And Schumann breathes quite differently. You know, he's full of this ardent romantic, you know, often palpitating, you know, incredibly intense music. And you have to figure out how to find repose within his, you know, romantic frenzy.
Let's talk about your parents and your early lessons. Your mother would be in another room kind of hollering out her critique of your playing. You're not the only people far less talented than you experience that too. So tell us what your mother would yell out to you while you were practicing.
Well, for her, there was a two-tier grading system. either the music danced or it didn't dance, you know. So I'd be there in the middle of, you know, practicing something, probably for the 10th time and completely, you know, losing interest in whatever piece I was playing. And she'd like, "It's not dancing, it's not dancing." And she'd be in the kitchen, you know, smoking or whatever. And this was, you know, as you can imagine, completely infuriating to me, you know. And I thought often to myself, "Well, why don't you come here and play it if you want it to be better?" Or stuff like that, right? Unfortunately, I think my mom's instincts were often reasonably good for someone who had no real music education, but she knew when the music was charming and when it was not.
While we're talking about your parents' feedback, what did your father have to say about your music when you were young?
Well, my father, both of them loved music, you know. He always wanted me to play this one Bach chorale, one very sad Bach chorale. It was called "Come Sweet Death," and he kept begging me, you know, every time he came home from work, "Jeremy, play 'Come Sweet Death.'" And then I would often want to play it a little bit. I was often impatient and just wanted to play it and get it over with. And he's like, no, with feeling. But he didn't want to impose so much in the details of my practicing. He just wanted me to practice more all the time. And he wanted to be sure that I was being responsible to my talent, you know, that was the most important thing, you know, how I spent my time and how I, if I had a gift, I had to devote work. And so I always had the, you know, he was a very, you know, both of them were very work ethic parents, you know.
The first piano you had was from a burlesque house in Atlantic City. Can you describe the piano and how your family ended up owning it?
Of course. Actually, my first piano was my mom's heirloom. You know, it was like a little brown spinet, you know, that just sat in the corner of our den for many years. And that's what I started on for the first year. But then, you're right, my new teacher, Lillian Livingston, who was an amazing and serious teacher in New Jersey with lots of kids, she said to my parents that I had to have a better instrument. And, you know, my dad had been a monk, a Catholic monk, until quite recently. And my mom had three kids and her husband had left her. So their finances were very tight still. They were very much rebuilding their lives. And there wasn't money to buy a fancy piano. So Lillian put my parents in touch with some piano technician, and he had been rebuilding this piano that he found, that he got, you know, basically for free from a burlesque house in Atlantic City. And it was covered with graffiti, filthy graffiti, honestly. It had been carved in, you know, various letters, RF loves TK or whatever, and then ladies like it, and some other things that I probably shouldn't say on the air. And also, it didn't have wheels, you know, it just was on these like little blocks that he'd built to sort of keep the piano in place. So once you got the piano in a place in the house, there was no moving it, you know. So it came into the middle of the den, more or less disrupting the entire TV watching area. And that was how I practiced, you know, from age 6 or 7 on, as in the middle of everyone's lives on this hideous instrument.
There's a story you tell in your book that I think is so telling about what your childhood must have been like as somebody who loved and was studying classical music. and who had no interest in the pop music of your time. And let's start with when you were in school. And I should mention here that you spent part of your childhood in New Jersey, which your parents hated. Then your father got a job in New Mexico, so you moved there. So your schooling was in both places, New Jersey and New Mexico. And it sounds like you were a kind of kid who didn't socialize a lot, kept to yourself a lot.
Yes, I think that's fair to say, yeah.
And probably part of that was because you were practicing all the time, and part of it is probably because that's how you were. So I want you to tell that story. You're on the school bus, and you're determined to show other people in the school how great classical music is.
Yes. Well, you know, I had to listen to all this music on the bus that other kids brought, you know, and so I thought that wasn't fair. So I had this backpack that was already kind of strained and overstuffed with books, and I pulled out some of them, and I had gotten a new tape, you know, like a boom box from my parents after a lot of pouting. So I got new batteries in there, and I stuffed in a cassette, I think, of Strauss's tone poems. And I put it in my backpack hidden, but I had it all set so I could, the play button was on the outside, so I could press it from outside my backpack, you know, surreptitiously. So I got on the bus, and we're going along the dirt roads, you know, and then I press play. And I think this is my great heroic moment, you know, to save the world for classical music, you know. And the bus kind of goes a little silent, and there's this kind of sense that they're all smelling something really unpleasant, you know. And then they begin to realize what's happening, and the orchestra starts to whip itself up into a, you know, a frenzy of Straussian splendor. And they start coming at me, you know, ripping at me and trying to figure out where the tape player is in my backpack. And in short, it's a wonder that I'm still alive, you know. After that, the Plog brothers followed me home every day from the bus, threatening to beat me up. So I paid a heavy price for that moment of heroic classical music advocacy.
You've had so many different teachers over the years, and some of them seem more mean, and some of them seemed more warm in their approach. What were you most receptive to? Like, what kind of feedback did you find helpful, and what kind of feedback did you find just kind of intolerable and would maybe even make you cry?
You know, I think I needed different kinds of teachers at different points in my life. I think, you know, one of the reasons I had such difficulty with, you know, my teacher at Oberlin when I got there, Joseph Schwartz, who was a wonderful teacher and a wonderful pianist, still is, he was so much like my father in many ways, you know. He was a little bit, you know, he didn't want to go overboard emotionally. He didn't want to micromanage. Every so often he would lose his patience. And those moments, I think they resonated so much from my past that I began to tune Joseph out. Definitely even by the, you know, the middle of my sophomore year, I barely remember my lessons with him, as if there was something, you know, deliberate in my mind that I was kind of... And I had met all these other teachers, you know, like I said, Norman Fisher. And Norman was the, you know, the diametric opposite of Joe. He was the ultimate kind of hugger and over-talker, and he wanted to go wild with every musical gesture and really get into the nitty-gritty of every single thing, you know? And he always wanted more character, more involvement, right? And that was the kind of teaching that I desperately needed. He was the first teacher in a way that encouraged me to rely on my own emotional life for interpreting.
See the teacher who told you to think about the saddest moment in your life for one piece?
That's right. We were playing a Beethoven cello sonata, some moment, and we weren't able to play it together. And he said to me, "Jeremy, think of the saddest thing that you've ever felt in your life. But don't, he said, don't tell anyone. Don't say it. Just hold it in your mind and then play the music as if that sadness was a baby you don't want to wake." You know? It's a pretty amazing image, actually, when I think about it. And indeed, it helped me to play at this slow, desperate tempo and to keep the spell. And then, of course, I put it in the book because I was in tears then. Even now, talking about it, I find it emotional to remember him saying that to me.
It sounds like the kind of advice you'd give an actor.
He was very much an actor, yeah, like a method actor kind of teacher. And I think still is, you know, he's a very active teacher to this day. And he was way too much in a way. He kind of violated my sense of dignity and privacy at the piano, which I think is what I needed.
How did he violate it?
Well, he'd get up in your face, you know, just like scream in your face, you know, more. Or he would just like give you this demonic expression when you were trying to play a really difficult passage. And that there I was trying to nail all the notes of the difficult passage. Whereas what his face was telling me was just let loose, you know. Stop trying to be the good boy, the teacher's pet, and start trying to create some kind of great emotional drama here.
Well, it's really been a pleasure to talk with you. And I thank you very much for coming back to our show and for your music.
Thank you, Terry. What a pleasure.
We should end with some Mozart. You have an album of Mozart. That's your most recent album. Do you want to just choose a passage that you especially love?
I think I'd choose the sort of middle of the last movement of 503. This is one of the most beautiful passages that Mozart ever wrote. The middle of the rondo of his concerto in C major, 503. And it's basically a love sextet between the piano and the winds with a simple melody, just three blind mice, over and over again, but with amazing and ravishing harmonies.
Thank you. That's Jeremy Denk at the piano from his album Circa 1300 to Circa 2000. Jeremy Denk's new memoir is called Every Good Boy Does Fine. In her new Hulu series, Life and Beth, Amy Schumer plays a woman nearing 40 who realizes that she's living a life she didn't really choose, and she decides to start again. Our critic at large, John Power, says that for all its occasional bumps, Life and Beth find Schumer still pushing hard in new directions.
With really brilliant comedians, there's nearly always a moment when they want to stop being only funny. To move beyond gags and skits and seek out new emotional, thematic, or stylistic territory. Sometimes this turns out magnificently, as when Charlie Chaplin began making feature films far richer than his comic shorts. At others, the results can be downright embarrassing. Think of Woody Allen's ghastly attempts to be Ingmar Bergman. But such are the perils of ambition, and I admire those willing to risk them. Take one of my favorites, Amy Schumer. Her series, Inside Amy Schumer, was one of the indispensable shows of the last decade, a hilarious, raunchy, take-no-prisoners program with a steely feminist core. Yet rather than keep making that series forever, she pushed herself in new directions. Writing and starring in the hit film Trainwreck, braving dramatic movie roles, even doing a cooking show with her husband. Now she's created and stars in an enjoyable new Hulu series, Life and Beth, about a woman in her late 30s trying to get back in touch with who she really is. She plays Beth Jones, a hard-drinking wine rep in New York who doesn't really like her job or her gung-ho jerk of a boyfriend. Then something happens that shakes her like a personal earthquake. Deciding to stop being, as she puts it, the passive passenger in the car of her life, she begins a voyage of self-discovery. This takes her home to the Long Island boonies and into flashback memories of the teenage Beth, who had to deal with the difficult mother she resented, that's Laura Benanti, and the feckless father she adored, winningly played by Michael Rapaport. Back then, the one truly happy thing in Beth's life was playing volleyball. Over the course of 10 episodes, Beth has all manner of mini adventures. She goes to bars and funerals and farmers' markets. She makes dirty jokes with her friends, many of them funny, and goes boating while high on mushrooms. She gets involved with a dim, hunky trainer played by Jonathan Groff, and a socially awkward farmer named John, played by Michael Cera with a charming dryness. Here, her past and present merge when she and her long-estranged father have drinks after he's helped her woo some wine buyers.
You gotta find that thing that gives you that charge. Why don't you do something with,
Don't say volleyball.
Volleyball.
Oh, my God. Come on, Dad.
You love volleyball.
I'm almost 40. What am I doing with volleyball?
You coach? They got the leagues at the YMCA? You're good at it? Hey, did I tell you that I'm gonna quit drinking?
No. That's great. Good for you. Me too.
Good.
Yeah, I'm quitting.
But not tonight?
No, not tonight.
Very soon.
Oh, yeah. It's at the top of my list.
The tippy top.
Now, as much as I like watching life in Beth, it's quite uneven. Beth's story starts a tad slowly, and its many tones never quite mesh. I kept thinking Schumer is trying to weave together two different strands of groundbreaking women's television. One is the strand that includes Fleabag and Somebody Somewhere, whose heroines grapple with the past in order to move into the future. The other is found in Girls and Better Things, which are looser in form and built less around a clear overarching narrative than around capturing privileged moments and scenes that often don't add up to anything bigger, and don't need to. I must admit that I never got fully invested in the grand arc of Beth's attempts to let the past go. Schumer's performance is plenty good. Her acting keeps getting deeper. Yet the whole healing narrative, complete with new boyfriend, feels tame and formulaic, especially coming from someone as original as Schumer. Beth's story lacks the emotional and verbal pop of Fleabag, or the deep body pain of Somebody Somewhere, whose heroine's wounds feel much more profound than Beth's. The show's at its strongest when it's less on point, giving freer range to Schumer's capacity for catching life on the wing. A spiky scene involving the Plan B morning after pill, funny sex talk with a black girlfriend who now chases white Jewish men, sardonic banter with her equally screwed-up sister, an explosion of post-coital rage at John, a lovely scene of Beth's dad teaching his daughters to eat oysters, not to mention all manner of good lines. "Do you have any pre-existing conditions?" a doctor asks her before an MRI. And Beth replies, "I'm a woman." Of course, one great danger of cutting-edge comics expanding their range is that they can wind up having their ferocious brilliance smothered by safely conventional material, as happened to Richard Pryor, a certified genius who literally wound up playing a toy. Happily, Schumer escapes that fate in Life and Beth. Although the cornball punniness of its title may give you pause, the show's best moments prove that inside Amy Schumer, the hell-raising spirit lives on.
John Powers reviewed Amy Schumer's new series, Life and Beth. It's now streaming in its entirety on Hulu. My guest Frank Bruni says that one night, he went to bed believing he was more or less in control of his life, but he woke up to the realization of how ludicrous that was. Before I tell you why, let me tell you more about who Bruni is. He's a contributing opinion writer for the New York Times who recently stepped down as a full-time columnist. Before that, he was the Times' chief restaurant critic, a position he was offered after serving as Rome bureau chief and White House correspondent. He's also covered the candidacy of George W. Bush. Before getting to the Times, he was the film critic for the Detroit Free Press and a Pulitzer Prize nominee. He's written books about George W. Bush, about his passion for food and his struggle with his weight, and the crazy-making process of applying to colleges and the fear of not getting into the right one. You can see he's written about life from several perspectives. Let's get back to why he woke up one day realizing it was ludicrous to think he had control over his own life. That morning, after blaming his suddenly blurred, smeary vision on a hangover, he realized the problem was his eye. It was eventually diagnosed as a rare stroke in his eye that irreparably damaged his optic nerve. The prognosis? His vision in that eye would never return, and he was at risk of having another stroke in his good eye. His new memoir about the emotional, physiological, and professional adaptations he's had to make is called The Beauty of Dusk. He's now a professor at Duke University and is joining us from his home in Chapel Hill. Frank Bruni, welcome to Fresh Air. Before we talk about your eye and about your memoir, I want to talk for a moment about Ukraine, which you have been writing about in some of your columns. How are you dealing not only with having to think about what to write about that would have significance, but also with the doubleness of thinking that everything seems trivial compared to what's happening to Ukraine and compared with the possibility of this leading to a wider war, possibly even with nuclear weapons, thinking about all that, but still going on with regular life?
I mean, I think we're all struggling with that, right?
Yes.
This is the story of all stories, and some of the outcomes here could be in the realm of the previously unimaginable. And yet, you know, we must go on with our lives. We must go on with our daily existences. I think it's just important that we be very conscious of this. I think it's important we remain informed. And something I try to do is just remember how blessed we are to be in a country that is not being buffeted by this sort of thing. To live in a country at peace right now is an enormous blessing and privilege, and I hope we all hold on to that.
What about as an opinion writer having to think of what to say?
It's really tough because I've never wanted to write anything that overstepped the bounds of my knowledge, and this is a complicated situation with a long geopolitical history and all of that. But there are strands and elements of it that I feel qualified to talk about and that I have focused on. I obviously, as a journalist, like you, I believe very passionately in a free press. I believe in the free flow of ideas and information. And so it has been fascinating to watch Russia clamp down on that, to watch Vladimir Putin essentially try to submerge his citizens in an alternate reality. And so I've tried to focus a little bit on that because that is a dystopian vision that should remind us of how important the free flow of ideas and information is and should make us better guarantors of that in our own society.
Well, let's get to your eye and to your new memoir. You write on the first page, "I went to bed seeing the world one way. I woke up seeing it another." And you mean that figuratively and quite literally. How has your vision changed when you woke up in the morning?
It was the strangest thing, Terry. There was a dappled fog over the right side of my field of vision. And I thought for hours that there must be some gunk in my eye, or you know, maybe I'd had too much to drink the night before. Then I thought, oh no, it's my eyeglasses. I just have to clean them. And on until deep into the day, I realized there was something wrong beyond all of that. Even then, I thought, okay, this is going to be fixable. You know, I mean, I'm a boomer with that sort of boomer invincibility and faith and medicine's progress and remedies. And I thought, okay, someone will give me a pill or a drop or eye calisthenics or I don't know, and everything will be okay in a few days. But that was not the case. I was told in short order that I'd had a stroke of the eye, of the optic nerve, that I'd never get the vision in my right eye back, and that I had to live with the risk forevermore that it would happen to my left eye. And that forced me to see in a different way, not just physically, but I had some emotional, psychological, and really spiritual work to do to accept this and figure out how to go on in the most productive and constructive fashion.
So this was like a rare stroke that happens basically in your eye and damages the optic nerve. And you were told by doctors, you know, corneas and retinas can frequently be fixed, but when it comes to the optic nerve, there's no fix. One doctor told you that optic nerve damage is the holy grail of solving blindness. I've never heard about this before, a stroke in the eye. Had you ever heard of such a thing?
Oh, no, not at all. And it is rare what happened to me. I mean, now, obviously, because I've written about it, because I've spoken about it, you know, I have an inbox that every week I hear from someone who has been diagnosed with the same thing. But we're a pretty small community of people, all of whom say the same thing. We didn't know this was possible. We didn't know this existed. You learn quickly, you know, and I, as a reporter, immediately launched on a sort of medical education of myself, and talk to the doctors like the one you quoted, because I was picking up the phone and learning all I could, both for the purposes of immediate journalism that I was doing, but also because I wanted to be as informed and empowered as possible as I figured out what, if anything, I could or should do about this.
So when the doctor told you that there was a chance this would happen in the other eye, and at first you were told a 40% chance, and then you were told later it was probably more like a 20% chance. But, you know, that's a lot of, that's still a pretty big possibility, even if it's only 20 or somewhere between 20 and 40. Did you obsess on that?
You know, at first, I think the way we're wired as human beings, there's a lot of mercy to it. And at first, I was in shock. And I think a lot of us go into shock when we get news that's difficult to process. And so I think weeks went by before I really, really took in what was being said to me. And then I was briefly terrified, but then I realized there's no point to that. I mean, I could, if I let myself give in to terror, if I let myself sink into depression, unless I'm willing to live in that state for forevermore, I'm going to have to at some point pull myself out of it. And the deeper I let the hole get, the harder it's going to be to climb out of it. So I ended up determined to show myself that I could adapt to whatever was going to happen, determined to talk to people who'd been through these sorts of medical travails, and not just regarding vision, but I talked to people who'd lost hearing. I talked to people who had been given Parkinson's diagnoses. I decided it was time to learn about how human beings at their most resilient survive and make the most of these situations. And that was my personal journey, and also the journey that I ended up describing in the book, which is not just my story, but is a collection of portraits of people who have survived and thrived in ways that I think are profoundly instructive.
You ask the deaf or blind question, like, which is worse, to lose your hearing or lose your sight? And a lot of people, including myself, have almost made a game about that, like a force to choose. Like, would I choose my vision or my hearing? And that just drives me crazy when I go down that rabbit hole. And I climb out of that rabbit hole by thinking, no one's going to ask you to choose. You know, this is like a pointless thing to think about. But you were thinking about it more from like a sensory level, like you lost your vision in one eye. How does that compare to being completely blind or to being deaf? Can you talk a little bit about reflecting on that?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yes. I mean, and it is funny. And funny, I don't know if funny is the right word, but as you said, it's kind of surreal that there is this parlor game. People wonder, which would I rather lose? And I guess you could extend the parlor game out and say, you know, what about sense of touch? What about sense of smell, sense of taste? You don't want to lose any of them. I was terrified, you know, of the idea that I would lose my eyesight. I'm not anymore. I hope I never do. I wish what had happened to me so far didn't. But, you know, you learn quickly that the senses that remain often become sharper in compensation for the sense that has been compromised. You learn how nimble the brain is. I mean, I've been shocked at the fact that sometimes in certain situations, I can take in visual information I didn't before because I'm optimizing what's available to me. I'm like focusing on certain details with my one good eye in a way that I never had with my two good eyes. And that's both a physical promise of sorts, but also an example and a metaphor, an example of just how nimble our brains and our bodies can be when circumstances demand it. And when you realize that, when you see it in practice in your own life, it takes away a lot of the anxiety and fear of what's coming down the road and, frankly, of aging. Because as we age, we're all going to lose certain physical potencies and be asked to make certain adjustments and compensations.
I want to talk with you a little about the subject of your previous memoir, Born Round, which is a memoir about your issues with food. You know, you love food, very passionate about food, and often went through periods of eating too much of it. And those periods resulted in periods where your waist would, you know, expand by, you say, like 6 inches. So given the issues that you had with food and with your weight, what was your reaction when you were asked to be a restaurant critic? We're eating like fantastic food and having to sample as much of it as you could was going to be your professional life.
I mean, I cackled, I think. It was surreal. It felt to me like the first scene of some crazy crazy movie that I wasn't sure was a comedy or a tragedy. But that offer, that proposal came along to me at a time in my life when I had just felt like I'd turned the corner in my relationship with food, where I'd gotten healthy again after a period of enormous weight gain, where I was living in a manner that felt kind of disciplined and healthy. And I somehow knew, Terry, in a really counterintuitive way, that if I accepted the restaurant critic job and every day was about dealing with food, that I would kind of approach it in a methodical and conscious enough way that it would be sort of the best recipe for not being undone by food that was possible. It's difficult to describe, and that's why I devoted much of a book to it so I could have the space to describe it. But I was probably at my food healthiest, at my trimmest, and all of that during the 5.5 years when I was the New York Times restaurant critic than I ever was before or since. I'm heavier now than I was when I was eating professionally.
How did you discipline yourself when you were reviewing restaurants?
If you are someone with a history of binging and purging and fad diets like I was, you're constantly telling yourself, I can pig out today because I'm going to be better tomorrow. And then tomorrow comes, it's like, well, I'm just going to pig out again today because I'll be better the next 3 days. When you wake up every morning and you know that you have to eat an enormous meal that evening because it's your job and maybe even go out to lunch, you can no longer lie to yourself about these incredible episodes of deprivation that you're going to commit to make up for tomorrow's excesses. And so you mete out your eating and you measure it in a way that you didn't before because there is no makeup period. There is no tomorrow when you're going to fast. And so I ate steadily as a restaurant critic, but I finished nothing on my plate. And being a restaurant critic is about tasting, not gorging. And that is, in fact, one of the healthy ways to eat that is often encouraged. And so it kind of kept you on a schedule and kept you to a discipline that wasn't so different from what some nutritionist's advice would be.
You hid your identity in ways that New York Times restaurant critics frequently do. You had like pseudonymous credit cards. And I was interested to learn that at that time anyways, American Express and the New York Times had a relationship where they would give you these pseudonymous credit cards so that you could use different ones at different restaurants and never be recognized as the food critic. Didn't they eventually have pictures of you on the wall in the kitchen? That's what I always hear about restaurant critics.
Oh, yeah, they did. And sometimes someone would like snap a photo of one of those and show me. I remember being told that when I was named restaurant critic, Eric Repair, the owner and chef of Le Bernardin, did such a deep dive that he actually contacted ABC's Nightline when he realized that I had done some commentary for them about the George W. Bush presidency, and he either paid them or somehow arranged to get a copy of the footage, and he made his employees watch it so they could not only see what I looked like, but be familiar with the sound of my voice in case my looks had changed. It's a high-stakes game because then, and I believe now too, for a certain kind of restaurant, a good versus a negative review in the New York Times can be life or death. And so they treat it that way in terms of wanting to know if the critic is in-house so that they can make sure, to the best of their ability, that everything is perfect for that meal and on that night.
One of the things that made me laugh reading about your life as a restaurant critic was that you learned, I think maybe after the fact, that some people made reservations in your name. Like, you're hiding your identity so people don't spot you as a restaurant critic. And at the same time, people are making reservations in your name hoping they'll get a great table and terrific special service.
I am told that still happens to this day. Although now the funny thing is, since a chef or a restaurateur is not supposed to hold me at a distance and is not worried that reaching out to me or interacting with me is going to be seen as inappropriate and end up being punished in some way, now if that happens, I might actually get an email from the chef or restaurant saying, "Hey, we're a little doubtful about this reservation we have for Friday night in your name. Are you even in this area? And do you have any plan to come into our restaurant?" And I'll say, no, I think you found one of my imposters. years. And what I don't know, Terry, and I very much wish I did, is what goes down when that person walks in the door, what kind of conversation they have with the non-Frank Bruni, Frank Bruni, you know?
Frank Bruni, it's been great talking with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Terry.
Frank Bruni is a contributing opinion writer for the New York Times and a professor at Duke University. His new memoir is called The Beauty of Dusk, On Vision Lost and Found. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Jenny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Thea Challoner, Seth Kelly, and Joel Wolfram. Our digital media producer is Molly C.V. Nesper. I'm Terry Gross.